Blog Talk Radio.
Couple days for you, other than the fact that the apocalypse is happening tomorrow. Donald Trump will be sworn in tomorrow. Oh boy, inauguration, here we go. Crazy, 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 crazy. So, for those of you who haven't listened to the live show this week yet, what I have for you today, I decided, if you saw the Secular Talk Facebook page yesterday, saw a little comment from me about how we're going to do a Q&A today for a couple reasons. And then tomorrow I'm going to be taking the political compass test on Inauguration Day. That's basically me saying I'm not going to compete with inauguration. So there will be no live show like you're listening to right now tomorrow. Instead, there will be what it will probably be a record-breaking long segment for Secular Talk on the political compass test. I'll take the political compass test and go into detail about all the different questions and my take on it and whatnot. And I'm not sure if that'll be uploaded tomorrow or that'll be uploaded Saturday, but I will also be live tweeting the inauguration. So you have that to look forward to. I say that like, it, you know, the inauguration itself isn't going to be the main attraction. But anyway, I think you know what I'm talking about. It'll be weird. It'll be weird to see Donald Trump give a speech. People are saying that it will probably be like very few people actually there, like half of what Obama had. So obviously Trump wasn't able to get any like A-list celebrities either, which is sad, sad. So he's going to have like, you know, fucking Charlie Daniels and shit perform. I don't know if Charlie Daniels is actually performing at the inauguration, but it's not. Let's just say it's not the same kind of names you would have saw if it was a Democrat who won. So, but anyway, a lot of stuff to get to. So, when I say a lot of stuff, I mean a lot of your questions, because that's what we're doing today. That's what we're doing. So let me go ahead and set this up for YouTube for everybody. And we'll dive into it. I'm going to take my time on each question and really go into detail and try to do justice to the questions. There's no way I'm going to get to them all, but it is what it is, man. What are you going to do? All right. So, without further ado, here we go. So, let me address it right off the bat. Yes, there is red behind me. Well, when we did the segment on Obama's report card and I posted it, there were still like 9,312 segments about, there's blue behind you, what's happening? Blue, 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 it's usually green, now it's blue, I don't understand, it's blue. It's blue, it's blue, and that doesn't even make sense. It's just supposed to be green, I don't even get it. What's going on here? And I addressed it in that segment probably like 20 segments into it. I'm just addressing it right off the bat here so that we can avoid those comments, even though me just saying that probably means there's going to be double those comments about the red behind me. So I don't know, I switched it up, man. So the green's never changing is the go-to. I mean, those are the official Secular Talk colors that happened in 2008. But now, between the specials, we'll do blue. So like Obama's report card, we did blue. And I guess for Q&A segments, we're doing red. Why? I just made it up. So that's what we're going to do. But I'm sure you guys will, I like this one better. I like that one better. Either way, that's going to be the layout, what I just went through. Regular show, green, blue for specials, red for random Q&As. Now, why am I doing a Q&A? Well, there's a Q&A because Secular Talk just passed, I can't believe this number, it's ridiculous, 9,000 YouTube videos uploaded to the channel. 9,000. 9,000. It's got to put us in the top 0.01% of YouTubers and how many videos they've uploaded. I don't know that for a fact, but, I mean, it's got to be around there. Definitely the top 1%. But, so we're doing a Q&A for that, and also because we just recently passed 450,000 subscribers, debating whether or not I would save the Q&A for 500,000, but I said, you know what, we might as well do it because between the 9,000 videos and 450,000, and I haven't done a Q&A in a really long time, and I rarely do them, but I got a lot of comments to get to. There's no way I'm going to get to all the questions. So there were 341 of them in the first 4 hours alone when I posted on Facebook about this. And by the way, I'm never, ever on the Facebook. Lilith does a great job running that stuff, and TYT posts some stuff there as well, but I'm never there, so don't expect me to see it if you're writing there. Just a heads up. I just randomly went on there and posted to ask for questions for the segment that we're doing now. But 341 questions in the first 4 hours. After the first 4 hours, I was already tapped out. There's no way I'm going to get to fucking 341 questions in the time span that we have. So let me shut the fuck up talking about other things now and get right to your questions, and I'll do my best to give a lot of detail and attention to each one. So I'm not going to give the full name because I don't know if you want that, but I will give your first name here. So Alex says, I'm a libertarian, and I notice I get along with far-left liberals very well. What do you think about a libertarian and progressive alliance being taken more seriously? This is something I've spoken about a bunch on the show, but I actually should probably talk about it more. I've been screaming about this for years. I totally agree there should be a libertarian and liberal alliance because, very simply put, we agree completely on about 50% of the issues. So you see this actually all the time in Congress. You see this in the Senate. Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul used to work together on legislation where they could agree. So, you know, for drug reform, for example, they can agree on various social issues. On foreign policy, there's almost complete agreement. So I never liked when Democrats or when libertarian Republicans only focused on the negatives about the other one, because you want to talk about true bipartisanship, that's actually principled bipartisanship, and it would make a lot of sense to do, well, this is it right here. The libertarian-liberal alliance is the exact kind of bipartisanship that I can get behind, the kind of bipartisanship that we have most of the time in Washington when it's not like formerly Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders working together. Is the bipartisanship where establishment Democrats and establishment Republicans both agree to screw you and both agree to sell out to Big Pharma and Wall Street. But when you have people who actually have an ideology, they have a philosophy, they're consistent, they don't change for hacky partisan reasons, well, then of course you could work with them. And, you know, I think libertarians happen to be almost totally right on social issues and totally right on foreign policy. Now, on economic policy, we disagree massively. Okay, but very simply, we don't work together on those issues. We will oppose each other on those issues, and that's fine. But, yeah, we should work together where we agree. So I never liked it when you had – Tom Hartman used to do this all the time. Tom Hartman and some other progressive hosts, who, by the way, I love. Like, I'm not – this isn't me saying I'm against Tom Hartman, who is actually an inspiration for me doing what I do now, but like you'll see segments of how they just go after libertarians viciously, and I feel like any conversation about libertarians from a principled progressive should include the fact that, oh yeah, by the way, I tend to agree with them on like half of the fucking issues. So I love it, and I think that you have a very rare thing in libertarians that you also get with, you know, the Progressive Caucus and the Bernie Sanders type Democrats and independents, where there's no fuckery. What you see is what you get. They're telling you exactly what they believe. You could totally disagree on half of it, as I do, but the other half where we agree and where you know you're dealing with an honest actor, yes, let's work together. So Rand Paul, he's done some great work with some Democrats, you know, I'd love to see more of that. And that's the only way, like in the NSA, for example, there's an issue right there where the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, however few there are, can work together with the Progressive Caucus, can work together with actual principled liberals and progressives to try to get reform and stop the government from spying on us. So there's, yes, there's a lot of room to work together, and I totally agree that there should be an alliance, even though on half the issues I also massively disagree with them and think they're a little off their rocker, like when they want to get rid of stuff like the EPA and the FDA and they want to have zero income tax. Okay. We're off and running, baby. We're off and running. I'm wearing a shirt. I look like a dad today, just for the record. I know all of you were very concerned about that and you were wondering about that. Well, I'm here to tell you that is indeed true. I look like a dad today. I got a shirt on underneath my jacket that's just too long. And this jacket's a little bit short on me, so it looks a little silly. But what are you going to do? Okay, next. So Raphael sends in a question here. He says, I was wondering if you had any advice for people who want to discuss important issues and get a following online via YouTube. I'm trying to make it in this field myself, but I've had little to no success. How do you make it in your business, and how do you stay motivated? You can't be in it for the reason that you mentioned here. So you're mentioning, I want to make it. I want to make it on YouTube. You have to be doing this because it's not really about whether or not anybody listens to you. You're doing it because you love it. You're doing it because even if you were in a fucking padded room talking to yourself, you'd be doing the same goddamn thing, because this is more about you developing your own philosophy and your own ideas and trying to get at truth and, you know, bring about justice. And as somebody pointed out to me a while back, they say, it almost looks like you're doing therapy for yourself when you're doing your show. And that's true. I would do my show if nobody was listening. You know, I would talk to myself in a room like this, and maybe that makes me crazy. So be it. I don't give a fuck. So you can't be in it for the reason of I want to get famous, or I want to do this, or I want to do that. It's all got to be for the issues on their own merit, and because you feel compelled to do it regardless of the consequences. If I was living in a fucking cardboard box, I'd still probably be doing this, because you can't shut me the fuck up. So you have to be in it for the right reasons. It's the same thing with anything. It's not like, do you think, some of the best actors, for example, Denzel Washington, Leonardo DiCaprio, Meryl Streep, whoever, you think that they went into this going, I can't wait to get famous? No, they went into it because they love the craft of acting. It's an art form to them, and it's something that, touches them but deep in their soul, even though I literally don't believe in a soul, but you get what I'm saying. It's something that gets at the core of their being, and they feel like, I have to do this, and I want to do this, and I would do this no matter what. You know, and as Jimmy Dore says to me all the time, and as he said on his show before, he's like, I would do this shit if I got paid nothing. Same here, man. So it's got to be more about that than about the end goal. The end goal, I'd never even thought getting into this, like, oh, there's going to come a time when I'll be noticed when I'm walking in the street. And I didn't even necessarily want that. But when you do it enough and you really care about the craft and you care about the issues, people see it and they're attracted to it. So, and this isn't just me. This goes for people across the political spectrum with different ideologies and people in various people who have careers in doing something that they love. So it's got to be more about that than anything else. And outside of that, it's just a matter of time. So I'm probably somewhere on the spectrum, because I'm a dude who I'll spend weeks and weeks and weeks and months doing the same goddamn thing day in and day out. And even though sometimes it might feel like a drag and it might feel like this is hard and it's really time consuming and I'm exhausted and all this stuff, I know it's the right thing, because when I'm not doing it, all I'm thinking about is doing it. So when I get a little break, when I'm 3 days in, maybe 4 days into the break, I'm going, I want to get back on air. And it's like, motherfucker, you were just on air for like a year straight. When I started the show, I'm not sure I took a break for years. I think probably worked for like two straight years. I mean, weekends, obviously. But I'm not sure I took like a vacation outside of necessity. Like, oh, I have to go to this wedding and it's far away or whatever. But I don't think I took a single vacation. And, you know, a lot of people look at that and go, that's crazy. But what would happen with me is when I was off, I would go, I want to get back on air. So to me, the crazy thing was not doing it. So it's just a matter of putting in a massive, massive number of hours. And by the way, it is true that you're going to get pretty good at doing something if you do it so much. That's not saying that if you're 5'3", you're going to make it to the NBA if you put in 10,000 hours or more playing basketball, because sometimes there are physical limitations, sometimes there are intellectual limitations, and that's just a harsh reality of the world. But I can guarantee you, you're going to get really, really, really good at whatever the thing is. So that's my breakdown for that. And to the final point, how do you stay motivated? That's a great question, because motivation comes in weird ways, man. It really does. So to branch off the conversation into a different area, it's like with exercising. You might exercise for like a year straight and then you kind of fall off the wagon and you're just exhausted and you don't want to do it and you're not into it as much. And then who knows, you'll see a fucking commercial for a hair product or something, some shampoo or some shit, and there's a dude in the commercial who's got a six-pack, and you're like, I want a six-pack like that. Time to get back to the gym. And it's just a little click that lets you do it. Now, for most areas in my life, the motivation is few and far between. So in various other areas, it takes a lot for me to get to the point where I say, I want to do X, whatever X is, fill in the blank. The one area where it appears like the motivation comes often, what I'm doing right now, the show, because it could be something as simple as, like, I see on Twitter a good series of tweets, a good, like, tweet storm, where the person, like, makes a good point in 5 or 6 tweets, and you read it in a row, and you go, oh, that's a good point, I wish I saw that first, and that motivates you right there. All right, where are my articles? Like, give me all the articles I'm trying to do on tomorrow's show, let me read through it, let me prep. You know, let me structure this in a way where I'm gonna present the story that not, in a way that knocks it out of the park. So, for the show, for whatever reason, probably because politics is maybe the biggest part of my life, I seem to get that motivation, a good dose of that motivation, fairly often. But in other areas, I, like everybody else, struggle to get the kind of motivation. Now, so it depends. If you feel that you're getting that kind of motivation to do something like this all the time, great, more power to you. And I don't believe in this dog-eat-dog philosophy. There's so many people in the world, so many people on the internet, and I'm happy when other progressive hosts or people in this general field rise up and they're doing a good job. So, you know, I'd love it if you get out there and you do it, but just know it's got to be a tremendous number of hours that you have to absolutely love it. And you have to kind of have that natural thing where you get the motivation refreshed often. And outside of that, just don't do it for the end goal. Do it for the process itself and do it for the art of the thing that you're doing. And do it because you care about the issues and you care about the substance and you care about philosophy and economics and religion and politics and all this stuff. So I hope that's a helpful answer. I'm trying to be as detailed as I can. But that's, you know, basically my response to you. Okay. Next. David asks on our Facebook page here for our Q&A session for hitting or surpassing 450,000 subscribers and 9,000 YouTube uploads. He says, do you think that Trump will be any worse on foreign policy than Obama was? That's a good question. The very, very direct, honest answer, even though it sounds like a dodge, it's not, is I don't know. My guess is, and my educated guess is, yes, he will be worse. Because Donald Trump, so he's kind of like Hillary Clinton in the sense that he's been on both sides of every single issue. So flip-flop galore. It's Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump, probably the three worst flip-floppers in history. You can find him saying anything. You can find him saying he's pro-abortion. You can find him saying he's against abortion. You can find him saying he's in favor of outsourcing jobs. He wrote an article in 2013 about that, how we need no trade borders. And you can find him saying, obviously, oh, yeah, I'm against TPP and against NAFTA and against all these free trade deals. So you can find him saying, hey, we got to get out of the wars and rebuild here at home. And you can find him saying, we're going to bomb the shit out of ISIS and, hey, let's take out their families and murder civilians on purpose. So he's on every side of every issue. So you can't go based off what he says. So then what do you go based off of? Well, again, I don't know what he's actually going to do yet, but the best indication in my mind would be, who's he surrounding himself with? Who are his appointments? Who are going to be the people who are in his ear the most? And, well, he's made crystal clear on that front, it's the establishment. Whether it be Goldman Sachs, Steve Mnuchin for Treasury Secretary, which is an utter disaster, whether it be Poozder, the fast food CEO for Labor Secretary, who doesn't believe in labor. He's going to be Labor Secretary. He's like, yeah, let's go totally towards automation. And by the way, fuck the minimum wage and fuck paid sick time and fuck paid vacation days. And I love Ayn Rand, whether it be that guy. Whether it be Rick Perry for the head of the Energy Department, who famously said, I want to eliminate that department. So that's all the establishment. That's all far-right goons who don't give a fuck about the American people. But when it comes to foreign policy, who's he surrounding himself with? Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil. So I guess there's one thing Trump said where I do totally believe him, and he repeated it more than almost anything else. We're going to take the oil. We're going to take the oil. We're going to take it from Iraq. That's what we're going to do. So maybe we have wars for natural resources that don't even have the pretense of a humanitarian mission. Because that's what they used to do. Oh, no, we're going to liberate Iraq. Anyway, give me the oil. But with Trump, it's, we're going to take the oil. So you got Rex Tillerson, as the CEO of ExxonMobil, as Secretary of State. Gee, I wonder if he's going to take the oil. So that's a very hawkish, scary thing. But perhaps even scarier, who's going to be the second in command at the State Department? John Bolton, the worst of all neocons. When he was considered for the job, he was going around saying, we should attack Iran, like, now. The guy has never met a war he doesn't like. He's the most. He makes Dick Cheney look like Noam Chomsky. He's so fucking hawkish. So that's the number two in command. This is a guy who's going to have, you know, President Trump's ear. So he surrounded himself with neocons and nation builders. And what that leads me to believe is he's going to take Obama's version of U.S. imperialism, which is soft imperialism. And what I mean by that is, you know, he's continuing two full-scale wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, but he's just, in the other places where we're intervening, there's seven places where we're intervening right now. Syria, Libya, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia are the other five. In those places, Obama's doing drone strikes, he's doing traditional airstrikes, and he's doing, in some cases, special ops boots on the ground. I think that under Trump, it's possible you'll see either continuing that or escalating and making it worse. And instead of doing the soft imperialism of the establishment Democrats, you go balls to the wall with the hard imperialism of the Dick Cheney variety, the John Bolton variety, the George W. Bush variety. And remember, he's massively against Iran. He's made clear that he's going to let Israel and Netanyahu do whatever they want and take more Palestinian land, which will further inflame tensions around the world. Perhaps the only foreign policy issue where Trump might be less hawkish, and this is a big if, is Russia and Ukraine, which I hope he's less hawkish on that, but it might be the case that Putin gets a little comfortable and starts doing some more nefarious stuff and jacking some post-Soviet states, and then everybody in the U.S. screams about Trump being weak, and then he responds militarily, and then we're in World War III. Also with China, how China's like, look, we're going to take the gloves off if you change Taiwan policy, because he's shown that he was like willing to treat Taiwan as an independent state. China's like, uh-uh, bitch. So if they do that, well, then we're in a trade war because China cuts off, you know, the flow of Apple products or other products here, as they say they will. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong. Trade war, actual war, escalation of the conflicts we're already in. You got to remember, he has the NSA to spy on everybody and their grandma, and it's in the hands of this thin-skinned buffoon who's kind of openly authoritarian in many respects, but with his media blacklists and suing Bill Maher over a joke and threatening to sue The Onion over a satire article. So my educated guess is, yes, all the half of the stuff he said on foreign policy, the non-interventionist talk, was just talk, and it was just something to say to try to get elected. He surrounded himself with hawkish people, and he'll probably do what the establishment wants and what the neocons want, which will be escalating many foreign conflicts. So my guess is, yes, he's going to be more hawkish than Obama, even though Obama was pretty bad because he went back on his hope and change argument and got us in more interventions than even Bush had us in. Okay, next. The next question is from Garrett here, and Garrett says, do you think the protests at the Trump inauguration are justified? That's actually a very good question, and my answer to it is both yes and no. So let me explain that. When I say yes, it's justified, Donald Trump is a guy who said many things during the campaign season that are disqualifying. And if they're any indication, if they're a 7% indication of what he'll actually do as president, he should be opposed every step of the way. So, for example, when he says, let's ban 1.6 billion Muslims from coming to the country, that's so outside of the realm of that which is rational that this person deserves everybody standing against him and saying, no, that's a bigoted position. What you're doing is you're saying, I'm going to treat all Muslims literally, because I want to keep all of them out of the country. I'm going to treat them all like, hey, maybe you're Al-Qaeda. Maybe you're ISIS. That's crazy. So you got to stand up and fight that. When he says, I'm going to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants, if he actually wants to do that, it's the craziest thing I've ever heard, to kick out every single undocumented immigrant. You got to stand up and fight that. When he says, I want to do nationwide stop and frisk against, minorities, it's used overwhelmingly against minorities. Over 90% of the time when they do a stop and frisk, it doesn't yield anything. In fact, it's over 95% of the time, it yields nothing. So you take away the Fourth Amendment rights of mostly minorities, because it's mostly used against minorities, and you don't get anything. So it shits on the Constitution, and it's ineffective on top of that. So he wants to do that? No, we're going to stand up and fight you. He says, oh, let's lower wages. We're going to fight you on that. He says, we're going to take out their families overseas. We're going to bring back torture. Fight him on all that. Fight him on all that. So the people who are protesting, yeah, I get it. Makes sense. You know, this is terrible. I say the no part of it, though, is there are a lot of congressional Democrats who are not going to go to the inauguration. They're sitting it out. And my reading of that situation is they're doing it more as a symbolic publicity stunt than as genuine principled opposition. Because the time for them to really fight Trump is when Trump and the Republicans are actually trying to get shit passed in Congress. So they already rolled over on Mattis, one of his picks. Now, by the way, that's the least objectionable pick of Trump because he reportedly talked him out of doing torture. So I get it with Mattis going through. But it looks like they're going to approve Jeff Sessions, for example. You know, it looks like they're going to approve Rex Tillerson. So you want to show me that you're principled, progressive, and liberal, and you're going to fight Trump, and you're going to resist the resistance. That's when you fight him. When he is trying to repeal Obamacare, which is going to kick 20 to 30 million people off their health care, and they don't even have a replacement, and even if they did have a replacement, it would probably be abysmal and not be anywhere near as good as what Obamacare is, even though Obamacare is really not that great. That's when you fight. They go, oh, we can't. They're going through budget reconciliation, which means that all they need is 51 votes to repeal. Okay, so then invent a way to obstruct. That's simple. Oh, you can't filibuster when it's 51 votes. Really? Well, watch me actually do it. When I have the floor and when I'm talking and when they try to get me to yield, I say no. And I keep going and describing how the Republicans are wrong and they're going to hurt all these people and X number of people are going to die as a result of this move. And you go on and on. You cite the poll numbers. Hey, each provision of Obamacare is overwhelmingly popular. There's only one provision that's not popular. So when you go issue for issue, policy for policy in Obamacare, the American people love it. It's more popular now than it's ever been. So, and then when they keep trying to get me to yield, I say, take me out of here in handcuffs. I'm going to keep talking. That's how you really obstruct. That's how you really stand up and fight. To do some symbolic bullshit like, I'm going to sit out the inauguration, it honestly comes across as childish because it kind of is, especially because the reasoning a lot of Democrats are giving is Russian interference in the election. Here we go again with that garbage. So they didn't fucking hack the voting machine. So stop implying that they hacked the election, The taste that leaves in people's mouth is, oh, Russia, like, literally gave the election to Trump by hacking the voting machines. That's not true. The strongest claim made against them is they maybe took the DNC emails and gave them to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks ran with them. To which I say, up your security, DNC, because you should just have good security. But we should have seen those emails either way. Those are genuine leaks that the American people have a right to see. That's transparency for the powerful, something the left used to always be for until it's used against the corrupt DNC and Hillary Clinton's corruption. Then they go, oh, how dare you do that? Now we hate WikiLeaks and we're complete hypocrites. So you look like babies because you are. You're whining, oh, we lost the election. Oppose him, but oppose him when it makes sense. Oppose him on the policy issues. This general idea of we're just going to treat him like he's not a legitimate president. But he is the president. Like, what do you want me to say? That's not – the vague kind of generalized protest is nonsense. It doesn't mean anything. No matter how much you scream it or how much you cry, he's going to be in the fucking White House. So get your ass to work and prevent the policy disasters that are coming as opposed to doing the symbolic garbage. So in that sense, no. If I was a Democrat and I was a senator or a congressman or whatever, I'd probably go to the inauguration because – I'm going to spend the next fucking 4 years obstructing this guy and being the actual resistance. I don't have time for fucking symbolic bullshit. It just comes across as babyish because it is. So for the people protesting him, I get it. And I agree with them in the sense that I think the actual people, the American people who are standing up against him, are just really concerned about a lot of the things he said, and they're right to be. So I get that. For the politicians, for the Congress people, no, you actually have a job to do where you can resist him, and you're going to roll over there, but you're going to do the symbolic gesture here, and that pisses me off. Okay, next. After this one, we'll take a break. Jessica asks us, did you have any other career paths in mind before YouTube? Will you branch out into anything else in the future? Writing columns, publishing books, etc. Okay, so, yeah, I'm like everybody else. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a professional hockey player, and then I wanted to be, I wanted to play football, and then I wanted to be a professional golfer. So I went through all, like, the sports. I'm a typical guy in that respect, or I was a typical boy in that respect. But I did know at a pretty young age, relatively speaking, that I wanted to do something with, like I'm doing now. That I wanted to talk about, you know, politics and economics and philosophy and stuff like that. And probably it was when I was about 16 or 17. And There's an interesting backstory. I've told the story before, but I came into politics in a weird way. I actually watched Bill O'Reilly's show a few times, and I thought, man, he's really good at, like, presenting. I thought he was he's a great speaker. He's one of those people who, when he talks, you listen. You're like, oh, he's saying something. No, let me listen. And it's not the substance of what he's saying. It's just how he says it. So he's a good presenter where he can keep your attention. So I stumbled across that and the 9/11 conspiracy theory documentaries, videos, the 9/11 truth stuff. Loose Change is one and some of the others. And I thought it was so bizarre because I saw a guy like Bill O'Reilly who was like so dismissive of those kinds of people, and he had his own narrative and his own like belief system. And then you saw like the 9/11 truth people, and you were like, how do you guys disagree so massively on, like, such a big issue? Like, how is there disagreement? It just fascinated me that there could be this big event, 9/11, this terror attack, disastrous event. And, like, people could come at it from totally different positions and be like, well, this is what happened. No, this is what happened. And this is my take on it. Well, this is my take on it. And this is what's really going on. No, this is really what's going on. And I thought, I got to figure everything out. I got to try to answer all these questions involving politics. And then that led, I mean, that led to me reading, you know, Richard Dawkins' books on atheism and Sam Harris and Noam Chomsky. I was reading Chomsky on anarchism as a teenager, way above my head, but nonetheless, I trudged through it and tried to digest little bits and pieces of it. And when I listened to, I used to listen to Tom Hartman on Air America Radio, and I thought, I really like what he's doing. It sounded so free. Like he would present the different, you know, stories and just talk about politics and tap into his wealth of knowledge about the different presidents and the tax. Under Reagan, the tax rate was this, and as a result of that, you had a boom-bust cycle because it was trickle-down economics, and it didn't trickle down to the people. It made the rich richer, and he would just talk, and it seemed so free and so open and so coherent, and it was like a canvas, and he was, you know, drawing a painting on the canvas and, you know, downloading that canvas into your mind so you understand politics better. And I thought, I love this. I want to do something like this. And then I realized at a certain point, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to do something with news and politics and hear my narcissistic ass talk all the time. And here we are. So in terms of the other part of the question, writing columns and publishing books and stuff, I can't give away too much. But let's just say my first official published thing is coming out soon. Very, very soon. We teased this a few times, but again, I can't give away too much, but something's happening. Something's happening on the left in general, and it's going to be big. So I'll leave it at that, but yeah, maybe down the road, a book or something, I don't know, possibly. But there is a little something on the article-ish front, maybe, kind of, that's coming very soon. So I'll bite my tongue here and not give away any more. But the answer is a tentative yes to every aspect of that. Okay. Let me take a break. When we come back, we're going to get into more questions. There's a lot of great questions here. Again, I'm sorry I can't get to all of them, but you guys did ask a bunch of great ones. So, anywho, we'll be right back. Stay right there, guys.
Popping bubbly, rubbing your spine. by myself. The left, please don't make me slap you with the left. The left, you will think so, I'm gonna slap you with the left. The left, I feel like I'm the left for a nigga left. The left, it's like I'm on an island by myself. The left, God, please protect me if this shit go left. Cause I can cook a kilo by my goddamn self. In the kitchen, water whipping with the left. I don't know what man, but I know who got the mouth. I feel like I'm a woman being mouth. Cause I can lock a truck.
All right, we're back, y'all. Let's keep chugging along here. Like I said, got countless stories for you. And by stories, I mean questions. But I'm making each one its own segment on YouTube. Okay, here we go. I'm 92.6% sure I'm going to pronounce this name wrong, but Cesari, apologize, man, if I'm wrong about that, says, you said many times that you would like to legalize, tax, and regulate drugs. What specific drugs would they be? What is your position on other countries on this topic? Do you think Holland now is going too far with regulating marijuana? Okay, so I don't know the exact situation in Holland. Are they legalized and regulated it? Because if that's the case, I totally agree with them. That's exactly what they should do. In terms of what does it like really mean when I say legalize, tax, and regulate, it doesn't mean that any kind of substance you can come up with is legal. It means you legalize drugs and you tax them, but you also regulate out of existence the worst varieties of them. So, to give specifics, would this mean that, you know, crocodile is legal? Well, no, crocodile is, the poor man's heroin, it's called. But it's cut with so many disastrous chemicals that the average lifespan after somebody starts taking it is like a year or 2 years max. It basically kills you and rots you from the inside where your skin falls off. It gives you that heroin-like high, but it's even worse for you than heroin. So would that be legal in this system where I legalize, tax, and regulate drugs? No. Instead, we would have a more benign version of that kind of substance legal. So we're talking about opiates or opioids. Lower-level opiates or opioids would be legal. When it comes to uppers, so like crystal meth. Well, crystal meth, same issue as crocodile in that it's cut with really, really disastrous chemicals. So how do you fix that situation? Well, you regulate out of existence crystal meth and you allow in a lower form, a more benign form of the same kind of an upper or amphetamine. So there is a question as to where the line is, but in my ideal system, you have a version of each kind of drug that is legal so that the majority of the marketplace can go to a relatively safe regulated substance to get the high as opposed to going to the black market to get a substance that could be unregulated and unsafe and get an even more potent high that, you know, could actually endanger them. So it doesn't mean that you have like crystal meth and crocodile legal. It means you have, you know, for example, the opiate pain pills would be legal. You have Adderall you'd be able to get over the counter. That would be legal. You'd have, obviously, alcohol, marijuana. Cocaine is on the bubble, you know. Maybe you have some sort of regulations as to how pure it is. And with the regulation, you also keep the black market open, but I think the black market would be smaller than, it obviously would be smaller than what it is right now. So it's also a way to tick down crime, like I said, because when it's all out in the open and it's legal, taxed, and regulated, well, that means legitimate businesses are involved, and when they have a problem, they go, and solve it at court wearing suits and ties. As opposed to now, if there's a problem in the drug market, what happens? You solve it with guns in the street. That's why there's a literal hot war going on. And it's called the drug war. The cartels are massacring people, and there's firefights, and there's mega cartels now that fucking behead people and act like ISIS. So the answer is to legalize, tax, and regulate drugs. But no, that doesn't mean that every single drug is regulated. Think about it like this. If I say cigarettes should be legal, does that mean that cigarettes should be legal and they should be allowed to put cyanide as one of the ingredients? No, you'd say that's crazy. Just because Kyle says cigarettes should be legal doesn't mean he's saying cyanide-laced cigarettes should be legal. That's not true at all. Well, it's the same thing. So we allow cigarettes, but we don't allow that ingredient in cigarettes. We shouldn't allow many of the carcinogens in cigarettes to be in cigarettes. You should regulate it to make it more safe, but you allow it. Same thing with drugs. Okay, so you should have various drugs legal, but you don't allow the worst substances, the worst chemicals that they're cut with to be part of it. That is illegal. So it's a complex conversation to have, but just know that a lot hinges on that last word, which is regulation. So when I say legalize, tax, and regulate, everybody gets the first two parts, legalize and tax it, but the regulation, a lot hinges on that, and that's why you need policy experts and medical experts and people to weigh in on that. And also, I do think that if you have a society that legalizes substances like that, which again is what I prefer, you should also have a system set up where you have rehab and, you know, a process by which you can deal with addiction, because there, of course, there are going to be legitimately addicted people, no matter how well you craft the policy. It's just par for the course. It just happens. So it's the same thing with alcohol. Alcohol is legal. There are many alcoholics, but nobody says, let's ban alcohol. So we should have a system set up that is there to help those people while still having the substances legal. I think I answered your question. Yeah, I don't think there's any other part of it I'm missing. Okay, so let me get to the other question in just a second. But it will not surprise you guys to find out that, that we have a problem that is now a daily problem on the show, which is the fucked up camera angle. Welcome to Secular Talk. I'm trying to fix it while I'm live on air because that's how I roll. Fuck me with a broomstick. I'm still having trouble fixing it. Hold on. I could have just taken a break, but I don't roll like that. I roll like a gangster. Okay, I think we're good. We're good enough. All systems go. All right, next question. And I think I have another question from that guy later, so I will mispronounce his name again. My apologies, broski. Cesari, I'll spell it for you guys, and you tell me how you think it's phonetically how it's said. Cezary. I was going to say that sounds like a WWE wrestler, but there actually is a guy named like Cesaro, I think, in the WWE. So I say that because it really is like super duper duper similar. Okay, next. Marcus asks, do you think there can be any sort of reconciliation between the Bernie Dems and the establishment if the establishment keeps taking corporate money? Also, should members of Congress be allowed to grow beards? I mean, Lincoln had a beard, and he was pretty awesome. Marcus, to the last part of your question, of course. Obviously, they should be able to grow beards. First of all, I have to admit, and this is slightly embarrassing, I guess, I didn't know that they weren't allowed to grow beards. But then when you think about it, I guess there aren't many people who have it. Well, I don't know. Keith Ellison has, like, a goatee. Paul Ryan had, what are you talking about? You sure they're not allowed to grow beards? Paul Ryan had a beast beard for No Shave November, you know, recently. So I don't know if that's true, man. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I don't know, but some have had it. But, yeah, of course they should be allowed if they're not allowed. And then do I think there could be reconciliation between the establishment Dems and the Bernie wing? No. No. They're going to step the fuck aside, and we're going to make them. You think I'm kidding? No, I'm serious. And there's a big announcement coming soon that I have to bite my tongue on, but their day is done. They're the problem. They're why who do you blame for Donald Trump? You blame them for Donald Trump. There are a lot of people who voted for Obama who ended up voting for Donald Trump because Hillary Clinton was such a representative of the establishment wing, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, that they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. I got to vote for Trump. At least he sounds anti-establishment. At least he says some stuff on TPP and trade that seems more reasonable. I got to do it. I got to do it. I can't vote for Hillary. So the Democratic firewall fell. She won the popular vote by 2.8 million votes or so. But they knew the states they had to pick off, and they didn't pick them off. She didn't step foot in some of the states she should have went to because she just assumed it's part of the Democratic firewall we're going to win there. Well, that wasn't true because former Obama voters either stayed home or voted for Donald Trump in many of these depressed factory towns because you represent the establishment. So this is the core of the problem, is the establishment Democrats. And now the same people who threw a bucket of shit on your head are the same people who are trying to sell you the relief from the flies. No, you're the problem. If somebody robbed your house, and then they come over the next day and they say, shit, man, you got robbed. We gotta fix this. Let me help you out. You robbed me. What are you talking about? You're the fucking problem. You're the problem. So no, there will be no reconciliation. Now, we have to be clear, though. The time for primaries and the time for elections, it's the primaries and it's the elections. So you know what that means? It means that if you have an establishment Democrat who happens to be right on an issue, like, for example, almost all of the establishment Democrats are still saying, hey, Donald Trump, please don't repeal Obamacare. That is a terrible idea. 20 to 30 million people will lose their health insurance. So on that specific issue, they are right. We shouldn't. Now, they would be wrong if you say, hey, should we go to single payer? They'd go, well, I don't know about that. So on that, they're wrong, and we'll fight them on that issue because we need single payer, and they'll stand in the way, and then they become our enemy on that issue. But on the battlefront of fighting to save Obamacare and keep Obamacare, which we need to do, they're going to be our ally. So we need to be rational, and we need to be reasonable about this. Don't just oppose anybody in a knee-jerk reactionary way. You have to think it through every step of the way. So if they're an ally on that issue, then we fight alongside them. I don't give a fuck if John McCain suddenly sees the light on Obamacare and says, you know what, we shouldn't repeal it. Great, come share a stage with me and we will fight on this specific issue. On other issues, I'm going to fight you. When it comes to war and how you want to start 93 of them, I'm going to fight you. I'm going to fight you and you're going to lose. But on an issue where we agree, yes, we need to unify and come together and fight them. So that's what that means. No, there will be no reconciliation between establishment Democrats and the Bernie wing. The Bernie wing will win, and we're going to kick them out of office. But in the meantime, while we don't have an election happening, if they happen to be right on an issue, we fight side by side with them for the correct positions. So that's my breakdown on that. Okay, next. Jeez, man, I'm getting through none of these. William asks the following question. Do you think that compulsory voting should be enacted in the United States? William, that's a great question. I'm forever 50-50 on this. So on the one hand, we already require people to do some shit that they view as annoying and they don't want to do, and I understand that feeling, jury duty. So they say, look, I don't care if you don't want to do it or you don't like it. You're a citizen of the United States of America. You have some duties. You have some responsibility along with that. You have rights as a citizen, or at least on paper you do, in the Constitution. The government has done a good job of trampling all over those. But you have to do some shit. So you get called in for jury duty, bitch, you go to jury duty. That's not a choice. So we have that's compulsory. Well, why is it we just skipped right over the most important thing? Like, the first thing one would think it is reasonable to be compulsory is you live in a democracy. You will participate in that democracy. So if you're going to have anything that's compulsory, that should be number one on the list. And by the way, what happens when you have compulsory voting? The Republicans will point this out as a reason to slap it down. They're right on the fact here, but they're wrong in that it should be slapped down. If you have everybody vote in the country, the liberals are much more likely to win. Because you do polling on the American people, and on virtually every issue, they're liberal. So when you have a lower turnout, historically, it helps the conservatives in the U.S. When you have a higher turnout, that means more independents turned out, more millennials turned out, and they overwhelmingly lean liberal. So the more people that vote, the more likely it is to go in a liberal direction. So if you had compulsory voting, you would have many more liberal victories. So I think that's good for the country to have everybody participate in the democracy. I think it's good that we move in a more liberal direction. But I think it's bad because I don't like this idea of somebody telling you you have to do some shit. So compulsory voting, half the time if you ask me, I'll say, yeah, we should have it. The other half the time you ask me, you say, look, some people actively choose not to participate, and they should be able to not participate if they don't want to participate. So I really don't know my answer to it. It depends what mood you catch me in. If you catch me in the mood where I'm in favor, I'll say I'm in favor. You catch me in the mood I'm against, I'll say I'm against. But I do think that the net effects for the country would be positive if you had compulsory voting. And it's not a crazy idea. Many modern nations do have compulsory voting. And we have one of the lowest, if not the lowest, turnouts among modern nations for our elections, which is abysmal for a country that loves to preach about how we're the beacon of freedom and democracy. So it's a difficult question. It's a good question. I'm still not 100% solid on my answer. I'm very curious what you guys, the audience, thinks. Okay, next. My stomach is growling, and it sounds bad. Feels bad. Jeffrey asked the following question. If you lost your audience in whatever fashion and couldn't continue the show for a living, what would you pursue? Would your format simply change, or would it be something more along the lines of finding something to pay the bills? That's a great question. I have two answers to it. The first answer is, I'm going to ride this bitch into the rocks. If every single one of you leaves and stops listening to me, I'll be talking to myself, and I don't care. I'm fine with that. You got to understand, when Secular Talk launched, when any talk show or YouTube channel or podcast launches, you are literally talking to yourself for at least a couple weeks. And that's if you're like really famous already and you start. So like Joe Rogan, when Joe Rogan started his podcast, not to shout him out or anything in a negative way, I actually love Joe Rogan's podcast, as I've spoken about many times. But I'm sure if you ask him, he'd say this is true. When you start, nobody gives a fuck. Nobody knows what you're doing. Nobody cares. So somebody who's already famous, he probably spoke to himself alone for, you know, I don't know if he had a guest or whatever, but it was probably nobody listening, and he's already famous. Take somebody like me, who I was beyond a nobody when I started. I was nobody. And I start talking, who the fuck is going to go, yeah, let me listen to this random guy talk about some shit. I mean, you're talking to people don't even want to hear people they know and like talk about politics. So why would they want to tune into a guy who they don't know and they don't know if they like him or not talk about politics? So I was probably talking to myself for months, talking alone to myself for months. You would prep shows. I don't even remember how long they were at the beginning, but maybe they were 30 minutes, maybe they were 45 minutes, maybe they were an hour. You prep a show, you go out there, you do it, and you do it knowing that nobody's listening to you and nobody gives a fuck. But it takes a certain kind of person and a certain kind of crazy to say, I don't care. I ain't doing this even necessarily for you. I'm doing it for me. Now, that's not really true because I also am doing it for the ideas and trying to get them out there, and I care about the facts and I care about spreading the message, so I hope people listen. But yeah, the fact of the matter remains, if everybody stopped listening, I'd be talking to myself in a room alone, and I'm fine with that. I already did it for a few months, if not a year at the beginning, so wasn't that bad. In fact, I kind of liked it. So as people have pointed out to me, it looks like you're doing your own therapy on this show. That's probably true, which is probably one of the main reasons why I continue to do it if nobody was fucking listening. So that's my first answer. Ride this bitch into the rocks. Don't care if I'm bankrupt and I have no money to my name. I'll find a way to scrape by and keep doing the show, talking to myself. Fine with that. That's one answer. The other answer is, if that just simply becomes impossible, like, okay, you will literally starve to death if you don't go do something else. I think, because it was always a dream of mine to be a professional golfer, I wasn't good enough. I'm laying it right out there. If you compare me to your average golfer, they would say, he's amazing, he's great, he's tremendous, believe me. But if you compare me to anybody who's a pro, I'm terrible. So it was always a dream of mine to do that. And it's long gone, man, forget it. The scores these guys shoot on the PGA Tour, I couldn't compete with that in a million years. Would I maybe throw my hat in the ring to practice for 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years, to try to get good enough to make the senior tour, which is, you know, 50 years old and up, where they don't play they don't have tournaments that are 4 days a week, they have tournaments that are 3 days a week. And the competition, though very, very good, is not as good as the PGA Tour. Do I think I have the ability to compete with those guys? No, I don't. Do I think I could get there? No, not really. Do I want to try it? Fuck yeah. Fuck yeah. Because nobody thought, like, for this, for what I'm doing now, who the fuck thought when I was an asshole talking to myself that one day we're going to have over 450,000 subscribers, over 20 million views a month. That's crazy, man. You're talking almost a million views a day. Who thought that would be the case when I was talking to myself? Nobody. So who knows? Maybe the first day you're out there practicing to try to make the senior PGA Tour, you know, you think there's no way this is going to happen. Cut to 5 years later, you're winning a tournament. Who knows? Who knows? So that would be the other thing I would try, but that's not really going to happen. This show ain't going nowhere, bitch. You're stuck with me. Next, let's go to Robert's question. Yeah, this is similar to something I already discussed, but Robert, it will be answered. That I can tell you, believe me. Believe me. Robert asks us the following question: how do you not get burned out on politics? Sometimes I just get so frustrated by the right and more upset by the left for not being left that I have to tune out for a couple weeks or I'm just constantly in a bad mood. Well, again, a few answers to that question. Number one is I do get burned out by it, so you're framing is a little off there. You're assuming I don't get burned out by it. I'm like everybody else. I get burned out every once in a while from politics, and that's when you take some drugs and do some chronic masturbation. Okay, maybe that was a little TMI. And that's only partially true. I'll let you figure out which part is true. I get tired every now and then, but it is the case that I get refreshed often when it comes to politics because for whatever reason I find inspiration in a bunch of different places to keep going and to keep talking about this stuff. And I don't know. I do get burned out, but I don't get burned out probably as much as other people, so I can continually get back into it. And does it put me in a bad mood? No. I feel like it actually puts me in a good mood because when you're talking about something and you're really trying to get into the details of it and the nuance of it and you're trying to, you know, come out with the truth and come out with a position on it, it is like a therapeutic thing, and it is it's the opposite. It actually makes you happy because you clarify it and you crystallize it in your mind. So I think it takes a certain kind of crazy and a certain kind of person to be as into politics as I am and to have my threshold be higher than most people in dealing with this kind of stuff. But I do, from time to time, get worn out, as anybody would get worn out. Tony asks, Kyle, been watching for a year now. Could you explain why the Republican base doesn't seem to get that the Republican Party doesn't at all care about their interest? That's a superb question, and this is one of the few of all the questions where I actually jotted down some stuff because I had to really stop and think about it. Like, ooh, why is it that the Republican base has totally and utterly fallen for the most obvious frauds in the country, the people in the Republican Party? That's not to say the Democrats are good. They're not. But, I mean, the Republicans are so obviously terrible. And there are people who fall for them. They really think, like, no, they're the answer. So how is that? Well, a few things. First of all, their lives are, in many respects, fucked up, and they're victims of a shitty system. So So it's not all like they're just bad people. So they are victims of a shitty system that's left them behind. But in their mind, you put complete and utter blame for that on big government. And in their mind, the Democrats represent big government. Even though there are countless areas where the Democrats actually believe in smaller government than the Republicans, they don't care. They don't think about it in a nuanced way. They don't think about it like, well, every Republican is in favor of the NSA virtually. And there are some Democrats who actually want to roll it back. So aren't the Democrats in favor of smaller government there? Aren't the Democrats in favor of small government when they want to end the war on drugs, the ones that do, and they want to let people out of prison and stop jailing nonviolent drug offenders? Aren't the Democrats in favor of small government when they say, hey, let's let a woman make her own choice with her body? Aren't the Republicans in favor of big government? So they don't really think it all through, but they just think in a vague, generalized way, Democrat equals big government. Big government is the source of all of my problems. So then it becomes a rational thing if you buy into that framework to go, well, Republican. Republican is the answer. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the Republicans have done a good job of pandering to dim bulbs in that, for whatever reason, Republicans tend to buy more into the vague, platitude, cliche way of talking. The Democrats, they're not immune to that, but there is a little bit more skepticism among the Democrats because most scientists are left-leaning and most, you know, skeptics and intellectuals are left-leaning. So there is more skepticism on the left. On the right, they really fall hook, line, and sinker for the platitudes and the cliches and the flowery bullshit rhetoric and the nonsense. So the Republicans have effectively co-opted the language of Christianity and conservative traditional values, where they talk about your lifestyle is under attack. Hey, the gays are now going to get married, and then your daughter is going to marry a woman, and you know all these alternative lifestyles are threatening what you know from your parents, and you know this you're dying out, you're an old breed dying out, and we're here to protect you. We're here to protect you. So we'll stand up for Christian values and conservative values and all these things. And then it doesn't even matter to them at that point if one of their own gets caught in a scandal where they're not practicing what they preach because they go, I don't care. They're for a bigger truth. The bigger truth is they're fighting to keep society to be traditional. They're fighting to keep society to be Christian. So I'm going to side with them even if they have their own problems like, you know, a Republican who cheats on his wife or gets caught doing a gay sex act or gets caught with drugs or whatever. But, you know, no, it doesn't matter because they're for the bigger truth. Even though they violated their own principles, they still believe in those principles of Christianity and conservative values and traditionalism, that they're still better than the Democrats who want debauchery. So that's the other part of it. Now, the third part of it is, I think, my reading of the situation, and I've had personal experience of this with family members. When you talk to somebody who really believes the Republicans are the party of the little guy, the Republicans are the party of the average Joe, and even the poor in some respects, what do they say? They say, oh, they believe in tax cuts. The Republicans believe in tax cuts. I want to keep more of my own money. Full stop. They want me to keep more of my own money, so I like them more. The Democrats want to take my money, and they want to give them to undeserving people, you know, parasites, moochers, lazy on purpose, can work but choose not to work. This is the caricature they've set up in their own mind about many Democrats and many minorities. So they think, well, they're the party looking out for me because they want to cut my taxes and let me keep more of my own money. Now, they happen to be dead wrong about this on so many levels because the Democrats actually cut taxes more for the middle class and the poor. The Democrats only raise taxes on the top 1%, maybe 2% of society, the richest of the rich, and you ain't one of them. So it's the Republicans who raise taxes more for the middle class and the poor. So they've effectively marketed something that is complete and utter bullshit. We're the party of tax cuts, we're the party of tax cuts, we're the party of tax cuts. They ain't talking about you, bitch, but you fell for it. So this is why I think many people fall for the Republican line. All you have to do is buy into certain things, just a couple, you know, a certain framework of how they view the world, and then everything else flows naturally from that, and you can rationalize and you can justify it, and you can really convince yourself that they're the good guys and the Democrats are the bad guys. Okay. Jace asks an interesting question here. He says, think you might be up for having more guests on your show, like maybe Jordan Sheridan or Jimmy Dore? My answer to that is, hell yeah, bitch. I love Jordan. Jordan and I talk every now and then. I love Jimmy Dore. Jimmy Dore and I actually talk quite a bit. So you're bringing up two of my favorite people. I also greatly, greatly admire their work, and I get inspiration for what I do from them. So if you haven't checked out TYT Politics, check it out. Jordan is, I think, one of the best journalists in the country, and that is not a stretch to say it. He's actually breaking stories and doing the right thing and caring about the issues. Jimmy Dore is a firebrand progressive of the order you maybe have never seen in your life. I'm not just saying that either. And watching his segments in many respects are therapeutic because you go, oh, thank you. Finally, somebody's fucking saying it. Now, I don't agree with Jordan or Jimmy on everything, but I don't agree with fucking anybody on anything, and that's to be expected. But overall, I love those guys, and I'd love to have a conversation with them. Now, we've also, since we've moved into the new studio here, which you guys funded because you're fucking awesome, we've actually done quite a few interviews. So if you guys haven't checked those out, do yourself a favor and check them out. So recently spoke to Rania Kalik, spoke to Mike from the Humanist Report, spoke to journalist Michael Tracy, spoke to T.J. Kirk, the Amazing Atheist. I was on their show, The Drunken Peasants, which you should also check out. I also had a long, long conversation. I've had multiple conversations with this guy, but I had one recently, a long conversation with Sargon of Akkad. That, I believe, is on his channel. You could check that out. And recently we've been trying to do a Kyle and Corin every week, which I fucking love, and I know the audience loves it. We get so many positive messages about that show from you guys. So, yes, the answer is yes. I kicked up the number of interviews and discussions that I've been doing since we moved in here, and I will continue to do it. And you're naming two people who are definitely on the top of that list. Jackson asks us on our Facebook page here, in a general election between Hillary Clinton and Rand Paul, who would have your vote? Ah, it's the age-old question, Jackson. That's what it is. I still don't know. People asked me this like a year ago. I was like, I don't know. I have to think about it. Here I am today. I don't know. Now, to some people, that's a crazy answer. If you actually go issue for issue, it's the furthest thing from a crazy answer. It is the most straightforward and correct answer anybody's ever given on any issue ever. So for Rand Paul would be better, I think, unquestionably, on foreign policy. Rand Paul is much more non-interventionist than Hillary fucking Clinton. Hillary's one of the Democrats that doesn't even really try to hide her interventionist, hawkish streak. She supported and orchestrated the intervention in Libya. She's in favor of doing even more intervention in Syria. Favor of Iraq, was in favor of Afghanistan. She would probably at least continue to do what Obama's done with the drones and the special ops in Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. Lord knows where else she would get us involved. So Rand Paul is definitely less hawkish than that. He's not as non-interventionist as his dad is. I tend to agree more with his dad on this issue, Ron Paul. But he's definitely less interventionist than Hillary, and he's said some good things on foreign policy. So for foreign policy, the answer is Rand Paul. For drug reform, I think the answer is Rand Paul, too, because he's more committed to at least decriminalizing marijuana, maybe even legalizing marijuana. Hillary seems to pay lip service, doesn't really care. Every now and then she talks about it. So on social issues and foreign policy, you go Rand Paul. Now, it's a little more complicated because Hillary, for example, is better on abortion. Rand Paul's, I think, more pro-life. Hillary's more pro-choice, but like a moderate kind of pro-choice. And actually, I agree with the moderate version of pro-choice that Hillary Clinton is. On economic policy, it's not close. I actually think Hillary is way better because Hillary would not get rid of the EPA, would not get rid of the FDA, would not eliminate the income tax, would not cut social safety net programs. And even if she did, she wouldn't do it to the extent that Rand Paul would do because he wants to get rid of those fucking things. So on economics, she wins. On foreign policy, he wins. On social issues, it's a little bit of a split. And then you have areas where they both suck, like TPP. Hillary pretends she's against it. I don't believe her for a second. She pushed for it 45 times, and at one point she called it the gold standard. Rand Paul, I believe, is for TPP also. So, and they're both, to an extent, bought. I mean, Hillary is kind of an extra level of bought because of her long-ass career and the Clinton Foundation. But Rand is also bought, too. So again, I don't know. Rand Paul is the one Republican who really makes me stop and think about, yeah, I might vote for that guy. There are conceivable situations and circumstances where I go, yeah, I'm voting for Rand Paul. But he's probably the only one of the Republicans that falls into that category. But yeah, the age-old question, I still don't have an answer for you, and I'm sorry about that. Okay. How much time I got left? What do I got? About 10 minutes or so? 8? 12 minutes? Something like that? Yeah, 12 minutes. Next. I have a question here from Birdman. Birdman, not the cartoon slash superhero, not the NBA player, but somebody named Birdman on Facebook says, what makes you identify more as a progressive than a classical liberal? All right, that's an interesting question, and it actually is a really long, complex conversation because political terms and definitions are always kind of shifting and changing as time goes by. So speaking as somebody who has a political science degree and who's been heavily involved in politics for a very long time, when I see people refer to themselves as classical liberal, my first thought is they really don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Because classical liberal, the actual definition of classical liberal is basically libertarianism, market libertarianism. So like a Ron Paul type character, an Ayn Rand type character. But today, people have started using classical liberal to refer to not libertarianism, but somebody who is liberal on social issues, on gay rights, on free speech, on civil liberties, but on economic issues is fairly progressive and somewhat social democratic in their ideas. So still in favor of social safety nets, still in favor of regulating the market and stuff like that. So part of the reason I don't refer to myself as a classical liberal is that there's a lot of confusion as to which term you mean when you say it. As somebody who comes with a political science degree and a background, every time I read classical liberal or hear classical liberal, I go, you're talking about libertarianism and you don't even really know it, which kind of gets under my skin. So I'm not going to use a term that's confusing when I'm even confused by it now, because I have to discern when the person's talking, okay, are they educated on the topic and do they mean libertarian, or do they mean it in the new way that it's being used? And by the way, I'm not even saying it should go back to the original meaning, because it appears like that ship has sailed and classical liberal now means the newer updated version of it, and it doesn't mean libertarian anymore. So I partially don't use it to avoid the confusion, but I also don't use it because it's not really all that specific and accurate as to my beliefs. It's a very kind of vague term, and somebody can read a lot into that. So if I want to be really specific with people and tell them what I am, probably the best way to describe it would be I believe in social democracy, and I'm a libertarian leftist, and I'm a secular humanist, and I'm an agnostic atheist. Now, I know that's a mouthful, and that's 8,000 terms I just gave you, but that's the most specific way of describing my belief system. I don't think there's any word or terms that really encapsulate it all, but that's as close as you can get. So let's try to go through that. Social democracy basically means I believe in a hybrid system between capitalism and socialism, where aspects of the economy have the free market and have competition and have privatization, but also there are things that are off the table and they're socialist. So healthcare, education, infrastructure, military, police, fire department, the usual. Basically, it's the Scandinavian model. Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden. They're social democracies. They're a healthier mix of capitalism and socialism. That's part of my philosophy. The other part of my philosophy, I said, is libertarian leftism. Libertarian means on social issues I'm libertarian, which means to each his own, do whatever the fuck you want, I'm not going to bother you. I really, really heavily lean on the side of freedom when it comes to social issues and when it comes to civil liberties, free speech. I'm a free speech absolutist, you name it. So drug policy, abortion policy, gambling, prostitution, libertarian on all those issues, do whatever the fuck you want. Leftist means leftist on economic issues. So like I was just describing, regulate the marketplace, make sure Wall Street, there are clear guidelines laid out there, you can't violate it. Obviously, have money out of politics, regulate that in a very rigid, strict way, make sure that's not violated. Corruption should be a huge, huge crime with very serious, severe punishments. Again, we should have strong unions. We should have a living wage that's a minimum wage. We should have universal education, universal health care, so on and so forth. Paid time off by law. Universal daycare is another thing that a lot of modern nations have that we don't even have that conversation in this country. So that's leftist economically. That's my belief there. And then what was the other? I said secular humanists, which I'm sure all of you know what a secular humanist is. I believe in humanism. I believe, you know, we should have a government that's not ruled by religion. That's secularism. A government that's respect individual rights and human rights and abide by fucking Magna Carta and the Geneva Conventions and the Nuremberg Tribunal. And humanism is, I believe in human beings. I don't believe in deities and nonsense. I think we should actually try to work this out as human beings. And agnostic atheist also speaks for itself. That basically means I don't know if there's a God or not, but I actively don't believe in one because I don't see any evidence for one. So if I had to describe my philosophy and sum it up in a quick way, give you the Cliff Notes version, although I could talk about this for hours and hours and hours, that's the Cliff Note version. I don't use classical liberal because it's confusing, because there are multiple definitions to it, and because it's really not specific enough. And so that's kind of why I avoid it. And by the way, the term progressive, I use interchangeable more or less with the word liberal. I know many people don't do that, and I know in some circles progressive has been sufficiently demonized to the point where it is indeed not equated with liberal. In my mind and how I use it, liberal and progressive are more or less interchangeable. And when you hear me use the term liberal or progressive and I say, hey, I'm a liberal or hey, I'm a progressive, what I'm really saying is, if you want to be specific, is everything I just laid out for you there. That's an attempt to encapsulate my philosophy of social democracy with libertarian leftism, with secular humanism, with agnostic atheism. I know it's a mouthful, I know it's a long conversation, but that's kind of my breakdown of it, and that's why I don't use the term classical liberal. Okay, next. Let's go to, what am I doing here? Oh, I got 5 minutes. I got time. Jorge has a question. Let's go to that. Jorge asks the following question. If we wanted to donate work like designs for shirts, a web page, et cetera, how could we contact you? Well, that's a very good question, Jorge. So for everybody who's a fan of secular talk and you listen to secular talk and you like secular talk, you need to know that there's a few people behind the scenes, but specifically one person who's my right-hand girl who does everything, and she does everything from Texas. Her name's Lilith, and her Twitter is at Stardust Lilith, STARDUSTLITH, Stardust Lilith. And every time there's something going on at Secular Talk that I don't have the time to take care of, I don't have the ability to take care of, she's there doing it. So every single fundraiser you've ever seen us do, whether it be the studio fundraiser, whether it be the multiple previous shirt drives we've done, that's all Lilith. Lilith sets it all up, does all the infrastructure, does all the groundwork, does all the mailing, does everything. So Secular Talk would not be able to run smoothly without Lilith. And Lilith has been super important and vital to the show for a very long time. She's been helping for a very, very long time. So first of all, follow her on Twitter, at Stardust Lilith. Second of all, if you have any ideas for potential designs for a shirt or something like that, you send it to Lilith. Lilith, basically, she's my agent, she's my manager, she's all that wrapped into one. And usually when the groundwork needs to be done at Secular Talk for anything, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, she's the one that does it. So if you have ideas for a shirt or something, you send it to Lilith, and she'll at some point make the decision when we do our next shirt drive. Okay. Now we go, like, oh, again, this guy, Cesari, man, he keeps getting questions. Lucky you, man. It's your lucky day, Cesari. Cesari asks, what is for you proper balance between taking in refugees from the Middle East and safety measures for U.S. and Europe? Okay, that's a great, great question. So when you look at the United States, when you look at the right wing in the United States, for example, the right wing is like, yeah, we don't want, like Trump said when he was campaigning, let's ban 1.6 billion Muslims from coming to the U.S. Let's shut it down. So they want totally sealed borders, and they just want to stop everybody for any reason whatsoever. No, wrong, you're not coming in. Okay, that is an insanely far right-wing position, and yes, it is almost the definition of bigoted, because you're saying 1.6 billion Muslims. You're all close enough to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or jihadists that we're not going to let any of you in. What about secular Muslims? What about liberal Muslims? What about genuine refugees who don't want anything to do with an extremist ideology? They just want to live a decent life, and they're trying to escape from those people. Wrong. You're Muslim, so you got to stay out. So you have that far-right bigoted position on refugees. It's not just in the U.S. A lot of places have it. There's a rise of the far-right in Europe as well. But then you also have, as reflected by some parties in Europe, you have this far-left idea on immigration, which is kind of this bleeding-heart liberal idea, which they're coming from a place that I get, like I get where they're coming from, where they say, well, look, we got to help these people. These people are in dire need, so let them all in. And in many cases, you literally didn't have any vetting process set up. You just let them in. Let them in, help them. This is what good people do. This is what we're going to do. Now, in my mind, the correct answer is definitely a moderate position, which is I'm going to let in refugees, and I'm going to let in a lot of refugees, but I'm going to have rational, intelligent vetting systems in place. So the way it works right now for the U.S., a lot of people don't know this. We have the most strict vetting system in the world. It takes about a year on average for somebody to get in here because there multiple government agencies do background checks and get records and they do biometric screening. And that, I think, is the answer. I would never sacrifice the vetting process that we have because I think you should vet people. But I also would never say, I'm just not going to let refugees in, because a lot of people really need our help, and it's the basic, correct, morally right thing to do, the just thing to do, is to understand, hey, what if the shoe was on the other foot, and there was some sort of nuclear attack or some sort of fucking super volcano in the U.S., and we had to flee somewhere else, and somebody said, hey, asshole, look at the statistics for mass shootings in the U.S. White males do over 60% of the mass shootings. Did you see the number of gun deaths in the U.S. every year? 32,000, or even more than that, over 10,000 homicides? You have a gun violence epidemic and a crazy white boy epidemic. I'm just not going to let you in if you're a white boy. But I didn't do it. Yeah, but others did. So we're just going to judge you by your demographic group. Oh, well, fuck that. So how would we react in that situation? We call that bigotry. Well, it's also bigotry if you say I'm going to keep out all Muslims or I'm going to keep out all Arabs or whatever the fuck it is. So, yes, allow in refugees. Do the right thing. But yes, have vetting to make sure you're getting people who aren't terrorists. That's obvious, I think. And then also what I would do is make sure Europe fucked up in that they let in refugees, but then what they do is they allow separate, distinct, almost segregated neighborhoods. Okay, that's in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. That's a fundamentalist Muslim neighborhood. That's a secular liberal neighborhood. Well, guess what? You're never going to get along like that. Because you're not united under one banner of, you know, hey, we're all British, we're all German, or whatever the case is. You have this rigid dichotomy, and the differences shine through over time, and there are cultural differences that never get ameliorated. So the right way to do it is melting pot. Easiest answer in the world. So the U.S. has been much better with, accommodating refugees and integrating them because we actually integrate them. So, you know, the melting pot is the right kind of multiculturalism. The kind of multiculturalism that has separate segregated communities is bound for failure. So the answer is let in refugees, but vet the refugees, and then make sure they go to secular schools and they mix with all the other Americans and they feel just as American as everybody else. That's the answer. Okay. I am out of time, guys. Maybe we'll do some of these later on. But here's the deal. No live show tomorrow. We have the inauguration. I will be live tweeting the inauguration. Then I will do later in the day. I don't know if it'll upload on Friday or Saturday, but it will be the political compass test that I will take for everybody, and I'll go into detail. So I love you guys. I'll see you back here on Monday. Everybody have a good one. Peace.